From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we learn how Endeavor, one of the most powerful talent agencies in Hollywood, fumbled in its bid to go public. Then Midnight Traveler shows how a family on the run from the Taliban documented their epic journey on cell phones, all the while sending footage to collaborators in the United States.
There was one time when we did have to use actually their mobile phone data in order to send the footage out because they were in a location where no one could reach them and they couldn't leave.
And the singer-songwriter Jay Sum takes us inside her music. All that coming up on The Frame. It's The Frame. I'm John Horn.
This is your Peloton. This is Robin. Robin is your instructor today. Robin is not going to go easy on you. This is you attacking the hill.
Last week, shares of the virtual exercise company Peloton plunged as soon as the stock went public, and Peloton's failure to launch sent shockwaves across the country and may have torpedoed the planned initial public offering of Endeavor Group Holdings, one of Hollywood's top talent agencies. Gene Mattis is the senior media reporter at Variety. Gene, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So how did a virtual bike riding company crash the party that Endeavor had to go public?
I think it basically sent the message that this is the wrong moment for the market, that IPOs are not performing the way that everyone wanted them to, and rather than go public and suffer that fate of trading below your IPO price, it was better to just sort of push the pause button and hold off for a while.
I think most people might recognize WME, William Morris Endeavor, as the talent agency, but Endeavor Group has a lot of disparate holdings, including Ultimate Fighting Championship, Professional Bull Riders, Miss Universe pageant. They've really been on a spending spree over the last couple of years, and I guess that's why they've racked up so much debt.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they obviously have been growing. There's no doubt about that. It's just they've been growing through acquisition. And the question is sort of, what's the upside for investors at this point? You know, you could see 5 years ago there's some upside, but like now what is the growth story? And they're sort of, well, we want to continue to acquire things, but there's a certain almost randomness to some of the stuff that they're acquiring when you think about Professional Bull Riders and how does that really fit in with the synergies of WME. You know, it's sort of a when you start to think about it, it doesn't make a ton of sense. And that was obviously the skepticism carried the day from the investors.
And even before Endeavor kind of postponed its offering, it had already shrunk the IPO terms from about $600 million that would have netted the company to about $360 million. So it felt like the trend was already not looking good before Peloton collapsed.
Yeah, I mean, and if you want to look at WeWork as another IPO that's also been delayed, in general, you're sort of seeing IPO investors being much more skeptical than they have been in the past about companies that sort of have a lot of sizzle to them. But then when you look at the financials, there's some question as to whether they're as sort of bullish as they claim they are.
Well, let's look at the financials of Endeavor, because what jumps out to a lot of people is the amount of debt they have, $4.5 billion. And if you follow generally accepted accounting principles, they lost almost $250 million in the first half of the year. So what is Endeavor's pitch to potential shareholders? Where do they see value and where do they position themselves as a growth company?
Basically, the argument is that they are a sort of unparalleled platform for top talent, the elite talent in the world, and don't you want to be a part of that? And basically what the investors are saying is that, you know, this doesn't seem like as bullish a growth story as we would like. It does not feel to us like a tech platform. It feels more to us like a agglomeration of different kinds of businesses. Some of them are sort of in the services business, which aren't really growth industries exactly. So I think there was some skepticism about the story that was being pitched.
We're talking with Gene Mattis at Variety. Ari Emanuel, who heads Endeavor, is not a guy who is used to failure or setbacks. So even in the context of IPOs that don't quite launch, this is, I think, a rare turn of events for Ari Emanuel, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think up until now, like the most you could say was gee, maybe he overpaid for some of these things. Maybe he overpaid for IMG, or maybe he overpaid for UFC. But, you know, as long as investors were on board with it, then, you know, you can't really gainsay it. So now you have investors sort of jumping off and saying, no, this isn't really working for us. And obviously, like, you know, he started in this tiny little office 24 years ago and built, you know, this unparalleled thing. And, yeah, you're right. It is the first real public setback, and you know, we'll see how he responds to it.
There are 32 pages of risk factors listed in Endeavor's filing to go public. And one of those, I think, is really important, and that is the ongoing dispute between the Writers Guild of America and the major talent agencies in Hollywood. They're fighting over representation, whether or not agencies are acting in the best interest of screenwriters, whether or not agents should be producing content rather than just representing their clients. How is that a factor in all of this, and where is that dispute headed right now?
The dispute is in court at the moment, and there doesn't seem to be any sort of active negotiation outside of that, although that could change. But, yeah, it certainly didn't help. The argument from the guild is effectively, like, if you're going to be in the representation business, then you can't be in the ownership business with the same stuff. That is a conflict of interest. And from the WME side of things, it was like, well, all of the growth, all of the upside for us is in the ownership. It's not in representation. So they were very, you know, eagerly pursuing that. And the guild is basically saying, no, you've gone too far, and trying to slam on the brakes. But, you know, it's very much up in the air, and certainly in the context of trying to go public, it was not helpful to have the guild out there sort of banging the drums the way they were.
Hollywood loves sequels and reboots. Is there any indication when Endeavor might try its initial public offering 2.0? Any news from the agency so far?
I think in most cases, companies that go to the IPO market and fail don't come back. I mean, they would tell you that, you know, the climate wasn't right, or the conditions of the investment market weren't right, and so, you know, maybe we'll wait for those conditions to change. You know, so they could be back next year, conceivably, but it's not certainly a foregone conclusion that they will be.
Gene Mattis is the senior media reporter at Variety. Gene, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Coming up next on The Frame, a family flees a war-torn country, but the father is a documentary filmmaker, and he turns their harrowing journey into a movie. Imagine a family of four. The dad, Hassan Fazili, is a filmmaker. The mom's an actress, and they have two young girls. After Fazili gets in trouble with the Taliban, his life is in jeopardy, and they flee Afghanistan. They don't know where they'll end up, but they use their cell phones to document everything. The journey ultimately lasts 3 years and covers 3,500 miles, and now that flight to freedom has become the documentary Midnight Traveler. The movie premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in January, where I met producer Emily Madavian.
I met Hassan through a mutual friend. I was programming a short film festival in California, and I programmed one of his films, and also one of his students' films. And I became friends with them and their kind of cohort of filmmakers. And I was talking to them about films they were developing. And during that time, their problems in Tajikistan with not getting asylum were sort of starting. Seemed as if something, as if it might not go well.
And part of this, the precipitating incident, was a film that he had made called Peace. And why was that important? Why was what the subject of that documentary said so important to, unfortunately, to his life and to Hassan's life?
It was actually a work-for-hire film, which is kind of a funny thing to have your life threatened over as a director. It was commissioned by the Peace Commission in Afghanistan, and it profiled Taliban fighters who laid down arms. And there was a main character who was a Taliban commander named Mullah Turjan, and when it aired, they killed him.
Because he had renounced violence.
In the documentary, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. There wasn't anything all that surprising about what was in the film beyond that. And in fact, Hassan isn't particularly proud of the film because he didn't get final cut on it or anything. They really cut it for TV. But, you know, it was effective at presenting the fact that this was a possibility, right? That you could, in fact, whether you were an everyday fighter or someone higher up, choose to lay down arms and return to civilian life. And that, I think, was the thing that so offended them. And they killed Molitor John, and then they put out a hit on all of the filmmakers, particularly the director.
And this starts an incredibly epic journey for them. At what point do you start to figure out that there is something that can be told here? And how do you try to figure out how he can tell this story of what's happening to him almost in real time?
Well, when we started the project, we really just thought, well, this is worth documenting, and who knows what it will become. So in the beginning, they did start shooting in Tajikistan before they left, which of course for the final edit was wonderful material to have, but we really didn't know what it would become. It wasn't really until they decided that they had to take the smuggling route, and until I started seeing some of the footage that I was getting back, then it became clear that what they were capturing was really harrowing and unusual. And so what we did is we arranged in each country for a contact to keep mailing me the footage so that he could hand it off and there wasn't any fear of media being lost.
And he and his family are shooting only on cell phones, mm-hmm. three total. And all of this data has to be somehow transferred back to you, because it's not like you can get on a local Wi-Fi hotspot and send it back, right?
Right, yeah. So they use phones that have SD cards that are removable, so they could swap out a lot of SD cards. But of course, there's a certain danger if something exists only on one SD card that it would be lost. So we were always trying to make sure that somebody could back it up and get it to me. There was one time when we did have to use actually their mobile phone data in order to send the footage out, because they were in a location where no one could reach them and they couldn't leave.
There is a subjective point of view that this film captures, because it is really what this family is going through from their own perspective. And you don't have what you would typically see in a documentary, an establishing shot. And it seems like it's a decision that you make collectively to not have that perspective. Why was that important? And how did you go about editing the footage to make sure that you are on that idea?
So what they were doing was capturing their lives, their own lives. They knew that, you know, the day-to-day elements of their life that might otherwise seem unimportant or boring were worth turning the phones on for. So I had a lot of just these people's day-to-day lives and the ins and outs and the happy and the sad and all of that. And we decided, when we were cutting, that this was a family story. It wasn't a political kind of polemic this was an insider story, and it needed to be told as a family story. So yes, the cutting was very much about keeping that feeling, so the audience is aware that we're in their hands. Yeah, I didn't use any establishing shots. You didn't shoot me that many of them, to be honest, because they're not a perspective that we have in daily life, right? It's a convention of, the Hollywood cinematic norm is to orient the audience. But on this journey, the family's disoriented. They often don't know where they are. So I didn't want the audience to have information they didn't have.
We don't know which camp police will give them, but yes, police give you a paper, and on paper is written the name of the camp where one should go.
When you get the paper, you have 72 hours to go to bed.
We're talking with Emily Matavian. She's the producer, writer, and editor of Midnight Traveler. So the family, over the course of the film, is in Tajikistan, Iran, Turkey, Bulgaria, Serbia, Hungary, Germany. Where are you in all of this geographically?
Most of the time I was in the U.S., but we did spend a month together in Serbia working on the film. And then once we were in post, we also all came to Germany to work with him and with the family in Germany, because they couldn't obviously travel for post. So we brought post to them.
But obviously, while you are at some points in the relative safety and comfort of the United States, you're seeing footage that is coming in where a smuggler is threatening the lives of the children.
Yeah.
And you're seeing the aftermath of an attack of a daughter in Bulgaria. What is that like for you to see, as this footage is coming in, what's happening to this family?
So some of the really more dramatic things, I knew about them as they were happening, because they would call me and ask me for advice or helps So I knew about the more dramatic things that had happened. I didn't know about the details. I didn't know what I was going to see in the footage. But on a personal level, the kind of being at that distance and just always communicating by phone and then getting the footage while sitting in the U.S. It gives you a certain perspective, you know, because they were in all of these really terribly harrowing situations. And yeah, I was in the, you know, the safety of my house in the U.S. And I couldn't imagine, even though I was talking to them at the time, what exactly it felt like to be in that moment.
Hassan is obviously a filmmaker and he knows what is and is not good cinema. But at a certain point, it feels as if we could be watching this story from anybody's perspective. How would you define the difference between what he brings to the way he might be shooting something to the way any other refugee might be shooting what he or she is going through?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few ways. I think there's a few shots in the film that are quite cinematic, but in an odd way, in the odd way that they're very personal. Like, there's a very beautiful shot when they're driving early in the film where his daughter's hair is waving in the wind and we see the world going by outside. And I think there's something really like sublimely beautiful about that. And it feels like what a father would be looking at in that moment, sort of pondering the danger that his family is in and pondering his role in it. But you have to translate that, right? Like, there's the having the feeling, which anyone might have, but then it's translating it to the visual medium so that the audience can also have that, register that thought or that feeling. And there's something about that particular framing, like the thought of focusing on her hair blowing in the wind, that captures that. So I think it's that kind of those moments of having the insight to translate what you're thinking to the visual medium.
I think for a lot of people, it's very difficult to understand the refugee crisis. It's very difficult for them to understand what conditions are like at refugee camps or border crossings. It's very difficult to understand the risk that people take when they're fleeing a country. How would you say this film is trying to address and get people to understand in a new way what that experience is like?
I think that there's a couple elements here. I mean, first of all, we have a family who's very endearing and compelling. So we care about them and we care about what they go through. You know, I'm hoping that when people see the film, it also sparks them to wonder a few things, you know, wonder about their own assumptions. You know, one assumption people tend to have is that everybody who lives in some of these other countries just really wants to leave their home and they want to come to the West. And of course, somebody like Fatima and Hassan, they actually love Afghan culture. You know, they love their home. That's why they were making art and making films and actually trying to make film that would better their own country, right? They were taking risks to forward women's rights, right? She was acting on television, which was quite taboo for some people, including her father. The other thing is, I think, recognizing that the route itself is extremely dangerous, and what you're asking people to undertake when this is the way that they have to have their case heard, is incredibly traumatic. So these two little girls go through years of really traumatic experiences just for the opportunity to have their case heard. And they do have an excellent case, you know, and we can imagine maybe systems that would have allowed them to have their case heard without having to put their family through this. But that's not the system that we currently have, unfortunately.
Emily, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
That was Emily Mahdavian, producer of the film Midnight Traveler. It opens in select theaters on October 4th. Up next on The Frame, singer-songwriter Jay Sum is the latest artist to be inspired by Joshua Tree, the place in the desert, not the U2 album. Indie rock pop musician Melina Duterte, better known as Jay Sum, is back with a new album. It's called Anako, which is Tagalog for my child. The singer, songwriter, and producer recently spoke with KPCC producer Itzy Quintanilla about her Filipino-American background and the making of her latest record.
Hi, I'm Melina from Jay Sum, and I play guitar and I sing. When I was about 12 years old, I started recording and I was writing music. I think I was really influenced by my dad's music taste. He had a really large collection of like 70s funk music and R&B music. He'd just be playing it all the time at the house. my mom would be singing all the time, and I think I just like picked that up at an early age, and I really wanted to learn about music and just sing and play all the time, and now here I am. For this record, I feel like I wanted to evoke a warm feeling, like a welcoming one. One where you can kind of like stay and feel comfortable. I think when I was trying to name the album, I didn't want to name it after a lyric, after a song, and I didn't want to name it after like a title. So Anaka comes from basically a phrase that a lot of Filipino parents tell their children, and it translates to my child. It's in Tagalog. It's like a really endearing term to kind of say to your kid. You kind of greet them like, hi Anaka, like I love you, like what are you doing Anaka? I was like browsing through my texts. I just like stumbled on my mom's text, and I thought it was like really cute that she was calling me this all the time. It like felt really natural and nice. Kind of puts like a little warm blanket over the record.
Tell me, did you fall in at first glance? Do you think you'll take a chance? Do you think on the weekend I could?
When I wrote Tenderness, I was in a really nice place and writing my record. I was so excited. I came off like a huge tour from the first record, and I think I just had this idea for this drum beat in 6/8. Very influenced by Tamia and her song So Into You, and I also wanted this song to kind of sound like Steely Dan, just like really sexy driving guitar. And I think for like the theme of the song, I just wanted to sort of convey this emotion of like being on your bed wondering if your new romantic partner is like thinking about you, and it's just kind of like a classic romantic song. Get Well is basically an open letter to a friend. It's also a letter that can apply to everyone, you know, friends and family and people that are struggling with addiction or, you know, wanting to be sober. Like a really simple song about wanting to be there for your friend and like being completely understanding and empathetic towards their situation. Nighttime Drive is about touring, which I'm doing right now. And I think I've always wanted to write a song about touring, but in kind of a positive way. Been watching hours pass inside cars with no glass, constructing shallow dreams of shoplifting at the Whole Foods. I feel like a lot of touring songs are about drinking and rock and rolling and stuff like that, but I wanted to sort of just make a simple song about my experience, and kind of encapsulates a lot of what's happened to me over the years.
I'll let my body win, shifting through the night, time drive, it'll be, oh.
feel like I write a lot about transportation because I think I love to write about escapism. I've had to think about this a lot because people are like, oh, another transportation song. And I'm like, I know, I can't stop. So I think it just comes natural. I think I always want to like leave and like do things and like fantasize about what's out there.
Jay Sum's music can be heard on your favorite streaming service. And that is it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.